WHYY is proudly supported by Penn Medicine. From groundbreaking discoveries to life-saving care, Penn Medicine's innovation is helping to change lives, one moment, one treatment, one patient at a time.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. If you're looking for some laughs this holiday weekend, Dave Chappelle has a new stand-up comedy special that premieres Saturday night on Showtime. He also has a regular series on Comedy Central called Chappelle Show that features stand-up, sketches, and music. In Rolling Stone magazine, Chappelle's humor was described as the edgiest, most racially charged comedy in America. The DVD of the first season is the third best-selling television DVD of all time. By the way, parents, some of his humor is pretty adult. Let's start with an excerpt of one of the most talked about sketches from Chappelle's show. Charlie Murphy, Eddie's brother, who's a regular on the show, is hosting an edition of Charlie Murphy's True Hollywood Stories, remembering his encounters in the 1980s with funk disco star Rick James. The sketch was filmed before James' recent death. As you'll hear, this fake documentary segment includes a cameo appearance by James himself. But it's Chappelle who plays the 1980s version of James. Here he is.
Drink up, be merry. Welcome to the China Club. A tongue, a tongue, tang, a tongue, 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 tang.
Rick's, you know, being Rick.
Come on, bitches, show me a tits. I'm Rick James. Do something. I wish I had more hands so I could give those tits four thumbs down.
I ain't realized how high he was. Next thing you know, he's like,
Charlie Murphy! What's up, partner? Darkness, everybody. Everyone, darkness is spreading. Go ahead, Charlie.
I'm behind the bar and I'm serving drinks, and Charlie bends over. I call. I said, Charlie, come here.
Charlie, there's a new joke going around. Have you heard it? What did the five fingers say to the face?
What?
Slap!
I asked Dave Chappelle to tell the story behind this sketch.
Eddie Murphy's brother, Charlie, was shooting a sketch on our show, and one of the conversations at lunch was about how he had fought Rick James on like 10 different occasions. So he was like, what? You got to tell us more. And then he told us the story, and we were like, okay, this is a hilarious story. You got to come tell it on the show. And then obviously, you know, we'll dramatize it with me playing Rick James. And then at a certain point, so we start moving forward with that idea, and at a certain point, Charlie's like, you know, I probably could get Rick for this. So we're like, sure, yeah, get him. and the rest is history.
How, I think you had been planning to do an actual movie, like a Rick James movie. How does his death affect that?
No, I'm not going to do it now. I mean, it was going to be a comedy. I was hoping to have him in it. At a certain point, he decided he didn't want to go that route with it. The 2 weeks before he died, perhaps I'd spoken to him for the last time. And I think one of his major concerns about doing the feature was, you know, how his kids would perceive it. And it was when I heard him explain it, because at first I heard he has problems with the movie. He doesn't want you to say certain things. And I was like, well, I can't, you know, I'm not going to promise that. That's a deal breaker. And then when I spoke to him, I completely understood where he was coming from, you know, because I'm a father. Mm-hmm. And he was just like, there's certain things that I've done in my life that I don't know if I want to see him glorified or whatever, or you know, lampooned. Just like for the sake of his kids, it was the impression that I got.
Dave Chappelle is my guest, and he has a comedy special coming up Saturday, September 4th, Labor Day weekend, on Showtime. And of course, he has his regular show on Comedy Central. Now, you do some really, your show is so funny. What was the original concept when you first sat down to conceive of your weekly program, Chappelle Show? What did you envision it being?
The idea was that I wanted to do a variety show that was very personal, almost as if like a comedian has a joke book where he'll write his ideas down. Almost as if you could bring somebody's joke book to life. And I think we were fairly successful at it in the sense that we do things on the show that are almost nightclubby, that aren't I don't know, things that I'm not even used to seeing on television. It becomes whatever it needs to be.
Well, it's
funny. One week it was a game show. Mm-hmm. One week it's a puppet show. One week it's half documentary. It can do. You can do anything.
We know what you're talking about it being like a comics notebook. In some of your shows, you actually set up the sketch with the story behind it, what you were thinking about before coming up with this sketch.
Right.
And that's what you did before a sketch called Racial Draft. And you explained that, you know, your wife is Asian, you're African-American. And so you've had these, like, arguments about whether Tiger Woods is black or Asian. So,
right.
So you came
right.
up with this show called Racial Draft. And let's hear the opening of that sketch.
Good evening and welcome to the first and maybe only racial draft here in New York City. Folks, this is for all the marbles. What happens here will state the racial standing of these Americans once and for all.
That's right. And the crowd is here to support their races.
Well, Rob, some of the biggest names in sports and in entertainment are on the line tonight, and I'm excited to see who's going to be drafted by which race. Seated behind me on the stage there are the various representatives, and believe it or not, the blacks have actually won the first pick.
Wow, that's the first lottery a black person's won in a long time, Billy.
Yes, and I'll probably still complain.
Man, f*** you. Well, the black representative is heading to the microphone now. Why don't we take a listen?
We in black delegation. Tiger Woods.
No surprises there, the richest and most dominant athlete in the world. His father, black, his mother, Thai. Well, it doesn't matter anymore because now he is officially black. Dave, the Asians have got to be upset.
There's no question about that, Robert, but you gotta think about it. He's been discriminated against in his time, he's had death threats, and he dates a white woman. Oh. Sounds like a black guy to me. Tiger's taking the stage now, and if you ask me,
wow.
Looking blacker already.
I'd like to say it's a tremendous opportunity for me to finally be part of a race, have a home. Been so confused if I'm Cavalcade and so many things. So long, fried rice. Hello, fried chicken.
So that's an excerpt of Dave Chappelle's show. Dave, can you talk about like what actually happened behind the scenes in writing the sketch, and maybe talk a little first about what happens further into the sketch?
The idea actually was a guy named Brian Tucker submitted the idea of having a racial draft. Finally, races can stop arguing about who is who and definitively label these people once and for all, which was like, you know, that's the heavy lifting. That was a brilliant idea. So Neil's my partner, I write the show with. We sat down and it was like a wealth of jokes that you could do because it's the kind of thing, it's a very race-obsessed culture. You know what I mean? Like when a guy like Vin Diesel becomes famous, there half of the things you'll hear about him is, well, what race is he? And he just doesn't say, which I kind of think is classy. Shooting it was a blast because, you know, we had the Wu-Tang Clan. We had Mos Def playing the black delegate. And that was one of the first sketches we had shot last season, which was kind of like one of those things where, oh, maybe this is going to be a good season. Kind of set a good tone for the season that we can kind of go anywhere.
Now, you're really funny at doing white people. And I think, like, when you're white, you don't think of there being, like, a white accent. Do you know what I mean?
Yeah, absolutely.
But when I hear you do it, I realize, okay, there's definitely, like, a white accent. So what do you do when you do white?
I take the rhythm out of my voice. I try to keep it monotone and even. But again, all right, see, I do these things. But I'm not really, it's almost like sometimes I watch old movies and how they portray black people, you know, with like Step and Fetch It and all these things. I remember watching them and something in the movie made me laugh and they were like, why are you laughing at that? And it's not that I'm laughing at black people as much as I'm laughing at the way black people were perceived. Like this is what they actually thought about black people, which just seems ridiculous to me.
Uh-huh.
So I think, you know, when I do that, I think, again, it's not malicious. And it's not necessarily what I think of life. It was just a funny character of what, you know, what the world looks like through my eyes.
Is there a particular person you conjure up when you do a white man?
Not a particular. It's a composite. It's a composite character.
Of who?
It's funny, man. All right. You know, when I was growing up in D.C. in particular, this isn't true for me personally, but there's a lot of black people that I know who really had never had any personal experience with white people, mm-hmm. which is weird to think about in this day and time. But D.C. is a predominantly black city, and because of the economic situation and whatever, they just didn't have any contact with white people outside of being authority figures. Officer, your honor, you know, if it's a teacher or a principal, but it's always some kind of authority figure. So there's this whole, you know, their experience with across the color line normally happened via television or, you know, or something where you're dealing with an authority figure. So I, on the other hand, you know, my parents were split up. My mom was living in D.C. My dad was living in Ohio. I traveled to both places. So I was in the nation's capital on one end. I was in the heartland of America on another. So, you know, I just culturally, I kind of absorbed a lot. I don't know, man. I got a pretty good understanding about the culture. I think that all these differences are just cultural things.
My guest is comic Dave Chappelle. More after a break. This is Fresh Air. My guest is Dave Chappelle. His series Chappelle Show is on Comedy Central. His new stand-up special premieres Saturday night on Showtime. You said in one episode of your show that after someone complained to you that your show was offensive to black people, and that person, by the way, was white, you came up with this idea for a game show called I Know Black People.
I know black people!
Welcome to the show, I Know Black People. We take contestants who claim to know black people and put their knowledge of African-American culture to the test. The contestant who answers the most questions, of course, wins our grand prize. Let's bring them out one at a time now. Our first contestant is a professor of African-American studies and history at Fordham University, the New York City police officer, is a writer for such black television shows as The Chris Rock Show and Chappelle Show. Okay, our next contestant works in a Korean grocery store, is a DJ, and claims to have many black... How can black people rise up and overcome?
How can they rise up and overcome? Well, can they overcome?
That is correct.
Reparations.
That is acceptable.
This is a rap lyric?
No, I'm sorry.
Oh, this is a general question.
This is an actual question.
All right. There's a complex answer there.
That is correct.
Staying alive.
That is correct. That is correct.
Well, stop cutting each other's throat.
That also is correct. How can black people rise up and overcome?
Get out and vote.
That is incorrect.
Dave Chappelle, that's such a funny idea for a show. Can you talk a little bit about what happened in the writing of the sketch, like what it was like to put this sketch together?
Originally, we were going to write the material. We were going to write it like an actual sketch. And when we sat down and started to write it, it was one of these things where it's like, this would be better if we got actual people and just quizzed them. And we just came up with questions. We just had them.
You actually got real people. You got like a white cop.
All those people were real. We had them get us a police officer, get us a Korean grocer, get us a black dude.
Mm-hmm.
Everybody. It was completely authentic. And then all the hosting elements were just like as far. Those were like off the cuff, you know. But the answers were incredible, man. The things that these people were saying. One of the things, they're going to see me, so they kind of go for being funny, but all of them were really nervous, and they were all kind of afraid that I was making fun of them. And then once we got to shooting, I think everyone just kind of relaxed and kind of unwound. And I don't know. That's one of my favorite sketches we've done.
Now, you grew up in different neighborhoods because, I guess this was because of your parents' divorce. If I understand correctly, you grew up in Silver Springs, Maryland, Yellow Springs, Ohio, because your father was teaching at Antioch College, which is located there, and Washington, D.C. You went to schools in these different places, too?
Yeah, I did elementary school in Silver Springs, middle school in Ohio, and high school in Washington.
Were you almost part of, like, different cultures in those different places? Were there different ways of, like, dressing and different music that your friends listened to, depending on which place it was, whether it was the suburbs or the city or Ohio or Washington?
I think elementary school was more integrated because, you know, people were younger. They mixed freely with black kids, white kids. Everybody was, you know, there was no real racial hangups in elementary school. And people weren't really clothes conscious because we were young. And then by the time I got to middle school in Ohio, that's when you start seeing alligators on people's sweater and people start getting into, like, status symbols and stuff. And that was the first time where I really started, like, hey, man, I'm poor. And, like, we don't have any money, do we? And then when I got to high school, so then I started getting into clothes. Then I go to high school. And, you know, I was gone during middle school. Crack came out while I was gone. So I saw, like, the before and after picture. I had to piece the crack epidemic together. Like, I remember my first day of high school, and they were like, all right, look, if you have a pager on in school, then there's immediate grounds for suspension, because we all know what that means. I was in the back like, I don't know what that means. And then, of course, I figured out that. And then I was also trying to figure out how everyone had all this, like, gold and expensive stuff. And then I was like, oh, okay, everybody's selling drugs. I knew so many people in the beginning, like my freshman year of high school, that was selling drugs. I can't even imagine how many people were using them. You know, the crack epidemic was crazy, man. And I think a lot of the stuff that I did in my act, just coming from Ohio and then going straight back to D.C. during the crack epidemic, I think that all the inequities were just underlined.
So how did you change as you changed environments?
It's funny, man. When I was in Ohio, I was the first, like, real confident period of my life. Like, I started gaining confidence because for these kids, I was this outsider, and I had to make friends. And that was when I got, like, this huge reputation. Everyone was like, this guy's really funny. I remember in middle school, everyone was just like, this guy Dave is so hilarious. Then when I got to high school and the crack epidemic was out, you know, what it took to be popular during that, I just wasn't willing to do.
Which was what?
You know, sell drugs.
Like, right.
If you didn't have money, you couldn't get the girl you wanted, you know. It was a crack epidemic. Selling drugs was like a legitimate job in the high school I was going to. And all around D.C., it was like girls like drug dealers because they had money. I wasn't willing to be that. But it was kind of like that context kind of isolated me initially. And then when I started doing stand-up, it was like I thrived all over again.
So when you started doing stand-up and you were still in high
14.
School? 14. Okay, in Washington. What were the jokes about? What was the humor about?
Man, the first act, Jesse Jackson was running for president, so I used to do jokes about that.
Like what?
You should talk about stuff I saw on TV, like Alf. But they all had race in them, one way or another. Obviously, Jesse Jackson jokes don't have some racial in them. Alf, my whole thing was like the alien comes 3 billion miles from space and gets a home with the white family. It was the paradox in that joke. Which all sounds corny now, but remember, I was 14, so it was like, well, you know. What else was I talking about? All kinds of stuff. Like, in the very beginning, I didn't know that comedians had material. Like, I thought they just went up there and would just talk spontaneously. So I used to do the same thing, which is probably better that I started that way, because that in and of itself is a skill that a lot of comedians are afraid to abandon their act. Once they get a good amount of time, they just want to stick to it.
So who were your audiences then?
All right, in those days in Washington, again, remember, this is a majority black city. there was no black comedy clubs. And I remember club owners saying things like, we'll never put more than one black person on a show because it offends the audience. I've heard all these things in Washington, D.C.
Uh-huh.
You know, it was pretty exclusive. There was one point where they actually had a rule that there was no more cursing on our stage. Which is like, this is in 88. And one of the comics who was black, this is pretty funny, he's like, look, man, he said, I curse. He said, black people use profanity because we live a profane lifestyle. And then he said something that I can't say on the radio. But he's basically like, if you see a roach crawling up the wall, you're not going to be like, golly gee, look at the roaches. You're going to be like, look at this motherfucking roach. You know, you're just gonna go for it. I know you're going to cut that out, but it was really funny, though. But just the fact, thinking back on it, the fact that there was all these limitations and all these weird issues that these club owners had, in one way, maybe prepared me for television.
Dave Chappelle, his new comedy special premieres Saturday night on Showtime. His series Chappelle's Show is on Comedy Central. He'll be back in the second half of the show. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air. This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross, back with comic Dave Chappelle. His stand-up comedy special premieres on Showtime Saturday night. His series Chappelle's Show is on Comedy Central. When we left off, he was saying that the limitations club owners placed on his stand-up act helped prepare him for producers' expectations in broadcast TV.
You know, before I had this show, I'd done 11 television pilots, which was very grueling. You know, it's hard to develop TV, man, especially if you're the youngest guy in the room. And at first I would defer to these people just because they were older than me and they all had suits on and I guess they know what they're talking about. But Dave, let me tell you something about TV. People want blah, 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 and blah, blah, blah. And our research shows blah, 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 blah. Done that 11 times, you know, each time it got progressively more frustrating. You know, I used to have arguments and all kinds of stuff. And the last straw, I was developing a show for Fox, and they wanted me to change one of the characters arbitrarily to make the character white because they felt like it would make the show, the word they used was have a more universal appeal. It's like, okay, you're the universe now? But it was like, it'll give it a more universal appeal. So I quit because at that point I was like, this is an impossible thing to negotiate. There's no way that, I mean, I don't know, you just can't make TV that way. Like, then how do you explain The Cosby Show working? Or how do you explain Will Smith's show working? You know, there were so many examples of successful shows, and these were considered flukes. Like, they were successful shows with all black cast, and it was considered a total fluke because of some pie chart this guy was holding. And that's when I was like, okay, there's no way I can do this.
My guest is Dave Chappelle, and he has his weekly show on Comedy Central and now a Showtime special coming up on Saturday, Labor Day weekend, at 9 o'clock. I want to ask you another question about having grown up in three different places, suburban Maryland, suburban Ohio, and Washington, D.C.
Rural Ohio.
Suburban
Maryland, rural Ohio, and Washington.
Okay, so that exposes you to different people, different cultures, different kind of geographic landscapes, different ways of living. And I'm wondering if that helped give you the ability to kind of stand back and look at people and see what was kind of funny and ridiculous and absurd about all of us. Do you know what I mean? Because I feel like you have that gift of just like looking back and standing outside and looking at everyone and seeing some pretty funny things about us all.
Yeah, because most of the people that are stereotyped, I know the people that the stereotypes are based off of. Like, personally, I've met people like this. You know, I can remember friends of mine growing up, like, we used to all play football after school and be like, it's four of us was black, two of us was Vietnamese. It was a Jewish guy from the Deep South. it was an eclectic group, you know, but we all got along. We all, you know, were friends. In the household I grew up in, my parents were somewhat, I don't know how to explain it, but over our mantelpiece there was pictures of Malcolm X. You know, I listened to Dick Gregory records growing up. I listened to The Last Poets. I mean, you know, there were books all over the house and always reading stuff. So like, you know, like people like Frederick Douglass, I these guys' pictures were on my walls when I was growing up.
You described your family growing up as the broke Huxtables.
Yeah, we were like broke Huxtables.
Your mother was is a Unitarian minister?
She was, yeah. She was, I believe she was the first black woman ordained in that Unitarian church.
And your father was a music professor?
Yeah.
What kind of music?
Voice. He used to sing opera and stuff.
So your family was really very educated and probably instilled those values in you. Was there pressure on you to do well in school and what you really wanted was to be a comic?
I mean, first of all, I was a horrible student. My parents, you know, my dad was very philosophical about these kind of things. As a matter of fact, I'm the first person in my family not to go to college, like since slavery. And my grandmother, my mother's mother, didn't like that at all. She, at first, because I was 17, I'm like, I'm not going to college. I'm going to move to New York and try to make it and stand up. And she kind of flipped out. She was like, it's a dream of mine. This is a heavy guilt trip. She goes, it's a dream of mine to see all of my grandbabies graduate from college before I die. It's like, well, I got to bring Diane up, man. That's a lot of pressure. But then my dad's whole take on it was, unless you want to do something that requires you go to college, then college could very well be a waste of your time.
And he was a college professor, so coming from him, that must have really registered on you.
Yeah, he was an educator. He was an educated man. And I think my parents ultimately wanted me to be happy. You know, I mean, my argument was, you know, Dad, if you're making a teacher's salary, if I can make a teacher's salary doing stand-up, to me, I'd rather do that than teach. It's like, and he understood where I was coming from. Like, you know, it's like I didn't necessarily have to be rich and famous. Obviously, I wanted to. But that wasn't necessarily my aim. I just really, 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 to this day, I really like doing stand-up.
Since you started when you were so young, your mother did she have to or did she just want to come to the clubs with you? Was that required as like an official chaperone because you were underage?
Originally, she had to. Once everyone started knowing me, this was kind of like our routine. We'd meet down at the club. I'd be coming from school. She'd be coming from work. It was cool, man. It was like a good way to spend time together. And then at a certain age, like maybe a year into it, you know, she'd get tired at night. We'd both burn the candle both ends, but I'd always want to go, so she just let me go. And you know, not until I'm an adult, then she tells me how scary that was for her.
In what way? You
know? I mean, she tells stories like she'd hear gunshots in the middle of the night. And, you know, she'd want, oh, my God, it's my baby. All right. I mean, remember, this is D.C. during the crack epidemic. But I guess in her mind, it's like of all the bad things that my child could be doing, he just wants to tell jokes at these clubs. And it was a controlled environment for me. It's not like the bartender's going to give me drinks. I'm 14. It's, you know, everyone kind of looked out for me. It wasn't like I saw stuff going on, but not really. It was more of a, it was really goal-oriented time I was spending there.
Now, when you were still pretty young, Mel Brooks cast you in his movie Robin Hood, Men in Tights.
Yeah.
What was it like to work with, how old were you? What was it like to work with Mel Brooks then?
Well, I was probably 18 or 19.
Mm-hmm.
And I was starstruck. Mel Brooks is a real warm guy. He makes you feel, he doesn't have any airs on him. You know what I mean? I get the feeling that he was real unaffected by his career. He's just another guy. He just loves comedy. And in certain ways, it was kind of a mentor relationship in the sense that I got to watch a guy execute a vision he had, a guy that I respected, and the guy that, I don't know, that was a crazy experience. But the thing I always think about Mel Brooks is he was just such a nice man, you know. Like, me and this guy really hit it off during that movie.
Did he give you any good advice?
I mean, I would learn from him more, and just like he would tell these stories, man. He told me about when he saw Richard Pryor for the first time, and writing Blazing Saddles and trying to get Richard in the movie, and the studio wouldn't let me, and blah, 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 and blah, blah, blah. And I mean, just him telling these stories just did a lot for my imagination, man, and he kind of inspired me. You know, I mean, for me, like, even when I started writing, actually, that advice came from Eddie Murphy. Excuse me, when we were doing Nutty Professor, Eddie Murphy was like, you know, you should really write because the way you tell jokes, he said, it's like you see jokes in pictures, which is kind of true. It's like I kind of, it's explaining these images I have in my mind. And he said, you should write, man. You got like a writer's mind. And, you know, and I think that's when I started trying to write more, just trying to self-generate. And thank God, because if I wasn't able to come up with ideas, I wouldn't work right now. I wouldn't be working right now.
Well, Dave Chappelle, thank you so much for talking with us. I really appreciate it.
All right. No problem. It was good to meet you.
Dave Chappelle's new comedy special premieres Saturday night on Showtime. His series, Chappelle Show, is on Comedy Central.